now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day coming up to a great weekend with an almost full moon up there in the sky. This is a weekend where there are some cinematic distractions for Americans. There are two new movies that are being released nationwide today. One of them is completely great. I mean it. It's a four-star movie all the way. The other one, an early contender for worst of 2020. I mean, really an unspeakably awful movie. So which is which? We will get to that. And a lot of people are riveted by the ongoing movie. It's a melodrama involving a whole herd of candidates who are struggling to win the Democratic nomination. That herd got thinned a little bit today. We will tell you about that. But let me welcome to the air Jason Riley, who is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He is also a fellow at Manhattan Institute and a Fox News commentator. His latest book is called False Black Power, and it is linked up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Jason, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. Your most recent column in the Journal actually kind of made the hair stand up at the back of my neck and on my arms and everywhere. You were saying we need to get ready to think about the possibility of Bernie Sanders as president of the United States. Well, first he has to win that Democratic nomination. You really think he has a shot?
Well, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility, Michael. You have to remember how he performed 4 years ago in the Democratic primary. He basically tied Hillary Clinton in Iowa, and he won New Hampshire easily.
By about 30 points.
Right now, Bernie Sanders is leading in Iowa and leading in New Hampshire. He could repeat that performance. Then you go on to Nevada, which is a caucus state. And after that, you have South Carolina, where he's pretty far behind. I don't think that's going to happen for him there. But if he comes out of Iowa and New Hampshire, comes out of these first three contests with a couple wins, he's going to have quite a bit of momentum going into Super Tuesday, where he also performed well. The other thing I thought was very impressive was his fundraising total for the fourth quarter of 2019. He out-fundraised everyone in the field and put up numbers pretty close to President Trump's, which is pretty impressive given, again, how many Democrats are still in this contest and that people can still donate to. And he did it after taking off a couple weeks for having a heart attack back in October. So he's going to have the resources to go the distance, I think, and to give the Democratic Party all kinds of headaches, just as he did 4 years ago.
I'm taking all of this in. 4 years ago, I think when they total up the number of votes he got in the primaries against Hillary Clinton, it wasn't really that close. He got about 44% of the vote. But if he can hold on to all those votes, obviously somebody, because of the divided field, if he holds on to 30%, not even 44%, then he's the nominee, isn't he?
Well, I think the problem here, as I saw it, and the reason I wrote the column is because, he's not Andrew Yang. He's not Tom Steyer. He is not a fringe candidate. And I don't think the press has been giving him the attention he deserves. I think his candidacy should be taken seriously. I still think Biden is the favorite, but I think we should keep an eye on Sanders. And there are some changes in this cycle from the last one. One is that Michael Bloomberg is going to be in play starting on Super Tuesday, which I think could help Sanders, because to the extent that Bloomberg wins votes, they're probably going to come from Joe Biden, his fellow moderate in the race. And you also have this 15% rule in these Democratic contests, meaning that you have to win at least 15% of the vote in order to be awarded any delegates. And I think Bernie is positioned to pick up 15% of the vote, even when the field is whittled down to three or four candidates in contest after contest after contest. Those fundraising totals tell me that his base is very, very motivated, and also that it's a large base, Michael. The average donation was under $20 in his last fundraising total.
Okay, this is all very pertinent. Now, that 15% rule goes along with another change in rules on the Democratic side, is that there's no more winner-take-all primaries. It's all proportional. In other words, once upon a time, and this is way, way, way back in the distant past, in 1972, the reason George McGovern won the presidential nomination is because he won, and just barely, just by a tiny sliver of the electorate, he won the California primary against Hubert Humphrey. And so he got all of the California delegates, and there were, I think, 300 of them in that convention. That can't happen again. This time in California, any candidate who has 15% or more of the vote gets a share of the delegates. So that's going to, and I think your analysis is exactly spot on. There are very few states in which Bernie would get less than 15% because there are that many people in the Democratic Party who are fringe progressives, don't you think?
Right. And after Super Tuesday 4 years ago, he went on to win a dozen more states. He just kept chugging along. He also won in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, in Michigan and in Wisconsin, I believe, which turned out, of course, to be these two very important battleground states that Hillary Clinton, of course, lost. And his supporters are still upset about how he was treated by the Democratic Party establishment 4 years ago. They think the system was pretty rigged in her favor, that she was chosen very early on by the Democratic elites to be the nominee, and they went out of their way to make sure that that happened. So they're very upset, and the reason I bring that up is because, let's say he does come out of Iowa and New Hampshire with some momentum, and some higher-ups in the party go, we need to stop Bernie because we don't think he's electable. His supporters will be very, very upset if they try to do that. And I don't think that the Democratic Party wants to risk upsetting Sanders voters, because I don't see how they can win a general election without his supporters rubbed up. And by the way, in head-to-head matchups with Donald Trump, he does better. Bernie Sanders does better than both Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren.
Not as well as Joe Biden, however.
No, not as well as Joe Biden.
Okay, this is all potentially very important, and it relates to a number of possibilities, because one of the things that I know the Bernie Sanders campaign is counting on is at some point in relatively early primaries, maybe after Super Tuesday, knocking out Elizabeth Warren. And they could do that, don't you think? Because she does not have the kind of financial resources he does. If Bernie's going to be in number two, number three in the early primaries, maybe except for South Carolina. But if Elizabeth Warren falls below number three in both Iowa and New Hampshire, don't you think she's in trouble?
I think she's in trouble right now, and I think she's doing a lot to knock herself out. There's a lot of self-inflicted wounds, I think, particularly the Medicare for All proposal and getting into the weeds on that. Now, obviously, Bernie supports the same policy, but Bernie's running as this visionary. You know, we'll work out the details later. I'm an idealist. I know what direction I want to take the country, and we'll work out the details later. Elizabeth Warren is running as the wonk, the way sort of Hillary Clinton tried to run. And when she tried to get into the weeds on this, she got a lot of pushback. I think that was a misstep on her part. So she's doing a lot right now to hurt herself. But I think what Sanders, and you're right. If you add up the Sanders supporters and the Warren supporters, Biden would be in trouble. So if one of those two drops out, Warren or Sanders, and throws their support behind the other, they could catch Biden. And the question has long been, which one will do that first?
Okay, what about the idea, which AI has begun to be talked about, which is that before Super Tuesday, or maybe right after Super Tuesday, Bernie, who's a senator from Vermont, sits down with a senator from Massachusetts, and they sit down, and Apparently, Elizabeth Warren loves to welcome people to her house to have a beer. We've seen that on a number of videos. So they sit down and they have a beer, and Bernie says, Liz, you're not going to make it. I would need you as my running mate. And the great advantage of that is Bernie would be 79 when he became president. She would almost surely be a natural successor if they actually won the presidency. And the idea of Elizabeth Warren joining Bernie Sanders on a ticket, would that likely give him high enough percentage of the, quote, progressive vote to actually win the nomination on the first ballot?
I think it could greatly improve his chances. I think something that dramatic might need to happen if Biden doesn't stumble. I think right now he's been quite a strong front runner. Everyone's sort of waiting for him to fall off the pace here, but he hasn't. And so I think it might take a dramatic move like Sanders and Warren working out a deal, saying, let's see what happens after the first few contests, or let's see what happens after Super Tuesday, and if one of us, if it's just not happening for one of us, you get out and you back the other one.
Okay, let me ask you about this, because one of the things that people say about both South Carolina and the Super Tuesday states, which include California and Texas are both now, quote, minority-majority states, where if you add up the Asian and the Latino and the black votes, you got more there than the white votes. In those states, does Bernie Sanders actually generate some kind of enthusiasm or appeal in, say, the African-American community in South Carolina and elsewhere?
Not nearly as much as he needs to. And this is a very big deal for Sanders. And I think it's something he's really got to work on. To the extent that he does have minority support, particularly in the black community, it tends to be among younger black voters who are less likely to vote, particularly in primaries. So he's got his work cut out there. Now, obviously a lot of those voters are with Joe Biden right now, partly because of his affiliation with President Obama as his vice president for 8 years, but also because they think he can win. It's Biden's electability that has won over a lot of black supporters, according to the poll. So, if Bernie again could pick up some wins in some early contests, I think it could go a ways towards showing those older black voters that he's viable.
Okay,
I think some of that vote is gettable, but he's got to perform.
And Bernie would have less problems, fewer problems in the black and Latino communities, wouldn't he, than someone like Pete Buttigieg? Obviously, there are a lot of Latino and black voters who are socially more conservative and might have problems going for a gay candidate.
Yes, that's certainly the case. And we heard a member of the Congressional Black Caucus from South Carolina, James Clyburn, say as much about this, that what he's heard and the signals that he is picking up, particularly, again, from older blacks, is that Buttigieg's homosexuality would be an issue for a lot of these older black voters who are overrepresented among primary voters. I also think that Elizabeth Warren's past could come back to bite her a little bit on this issue, particularly with this deal with her, spending her adult life posing as a Native American in order to advance her professional career and take advantage of policies put in place to help blacks advance. Now, again, President Trump makes a lot of hay out of this, but I think a lot of black voters would be offended when they find out about this, and she hasn't really answered for that. She's apologized for saying she was a member of a particular tribe, but she has not taken back the claim, the underlying claim, that she's Native American.
Do you have a part Native American background, Jason?
I have no idea.
But and you probably don't care.
I have at least as much as Elizabeth Warren.
Right, probably as much so. Here is one area in the minutes left to us where we have to take on the conventional wisdom. I think conventional wisdom on the Republican side is a lot of hand-rubbing. Oh, Bernie's the nominee? Boy, that's the dream candidate to run against Trump. Trump can win 40 states, 45 states. did slaughter Bernie Sanders. You, Jason Riley, say in the Wall Street Journal, not so fast.
Right. And the reason I say that, Michael, is because, I mean, we had another great jobs report today. The economy is humming along. 3.5% unemployment, record low unemployment for blacks, wages are up, and yet you look at the president's job approval number, and it's still stuck in the 40s. He is not getting the credit that you would expect a president to get in an economy doing this well. And what that tells me is that he is vulnerable. He is vulnerable no matter who the nominee turns out to be, and he is going to have his work cut out. I think, yes, on paper, he'd rather run against a more progressive candidate, play up the socialism and so forth, rather than a Joe Biden. But I do believe that when I look at that, at how well the economy is doing and how low his approval rating is, I say he's vulnerable.
Well, the one thing about Bernie Sanders, and one has to acknowledge it, There are very few people who are like super excited. I mean, really are going to spend hours and hours a week volunteering for Joe Biden. There may be a few for Elizabeth Warren. There may be a few for Pete Buttigieg. But there are literally millions of people like that who are committing time and money to the Sanders campaign. And I think they're all nuts. I mean, I think that they do embrace a dream of socialism and an open socialist. But he would have an enthusiastic army of folks working on behalf of his campaign, wouldn't he?
He would and does. Again, I think he's got the infrastructure and the money to go the distance again, even if he doesn't ultimately win the nomination. But yeah, I'm with you. You have to hope that proposals like taking away private health insurance and his isolationism on foreign policy. And
where does he stand on reparations? Do you know, is he a pro-reparations?
I think he's a little more favorable to them than he was last go-round. So he hasn't ruled them out. But the wealth redistribution, all of that, I think it'd be horrible for the country. And I think I'd like to think that most Americans will ultimately reject it. But again, the question, you know, if this is a referendum on the current president, who knows what could happen?
Yeah, I was speaking to some folks sympathetic to Bernie Sanders supporting his campaign. Said, okay, who's Bernie's running mate? And you know what the answer was?
No.
Some female general. Which, by the way, makes a lot of sense. Because obviously on national security issues, Bernie Sanders was fairly unique in describing the killing of Soleimani as an assassination. That's not going to play well in a general election, is it?
I don't think so. I suspect that Trump's handling of this has only helped him with the general public. And I think that the Democrats are making a big mistake in trying to spin this as somehow a bad move that we shouldn't have moved forward on. I think Trump's going to win this argument.
That's Jason Riley. His most recent book is False Black Power? He writes consistently week after week, and I admire your ability to do so in this political climate. Columns that are fresh and eloquent and substantive and thought-provoking for The Wall Street Journal. He's also a fellow of the Manhattan Institute, a senior fellow. Coming up, there's a surprise endorsement by somebody with an unbelievably strong social media following and exactly the kind of, well, strong, thoughtful, disciplined, nationally respected female voice that maybe Bernie Sanders needs as a running mate. In any event, she has endorsed Bernie Sanders. Who are we talking about? We'll tell you in moments. Plus, Tulsi Gabbard agreeing with Pete Buttigieg in one of the worst statements of his campaign. We'll get to that and much more coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
He has control over this world.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved show, which senior stateswoman has thrown in her lot with the Bernie Sanders campaign? Someone almost universally respected, particularly for her foreign policy experience, her policy analysis, and much, much more. I'm talking, of course, about actress and supermodel Emily Ratajkowski. And she has just released a video where she goes right to the essence of the issues in this campaign with a probing analysis and very tough-to-refute arguments on behalf of Senator Sanders. Listen.
Hi, I'm Emily Ratajkowski, and I'm endorsing Bernie Sanders for president. I'm 28. I'm a millennial, a true millennial. You know, I think one of the things that's so interesting about young people supporting Bernie Sanders is that he's not like a young, sexy candidate. What he says speaks so much to what people want, that sort of who he is, it's so much beyond just one man. Bernie is extremely genuine. He's consistent. He's powerful, not because of who he is as one person, but because of the way that he invigorates people and excites them and brings together this movement. So when Bernie sort of popped up on the radar as this guy who had been arrested in the 60s and had been consistent in his policies, not only has he always advocated for healthcare, he's also always been on the right side as far as civil and humanitarian issues.
Who is going to be speaking out for people who need someone to speak out for them?
It just was like, this is our man. Women in this country have so much to lose as far as healthcare. This is a potential moment in the Supreme Court where Roe v. Wade could be overturned. So whoever's going to be our next Supreme Court justice will be up.
Okay. In any event, that's Emily Ratajkowski. Look, could this help Bernie Sanders with a crucial demographic, which is a horny 14-year-old boys? of every age. And here's the deal. I said of every age because people who are actually 14 can't vote. But by the way, did you see that? Guys, we should do this. Nancy Pelosi has lent her name to support lowering the voting age to 16, which is exactly what we need. I mean, right? Not exactly. But with Emily Ratajkowski, she was... I did appreciate her acting work. No, I'm not kidding. She was in the movie Entourage, and she was totally convincing playing herself. And she did play herself. There's some recent headlines that have appeared. The New York Post, which, of course, the New York Post is a conservative newspaper, but they had the following recent headline about Emily Ratajkowski. Millionaires Emily Ratajkowski and her husband lived rent-free in the couple's NoHo loft thanks to a legal loophole meant to protect struggling artists. And then Fox News reported, they're also associated with the Rupert Murdoch empire, as is the New York Post, skipped out on $160,000 in rent, had to be paid to leave, according to Fox News. And back during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, she got herself arrested with another supermodel, Amy Schumer. Then appeared on Jimmy Kimmel's show to talk about her profound and ill-fated stance.
So I had just landed from Europe, and I got Wi-Fi. I got this text message that was like, hey, want to get arrested with me this week? And I was like, I knew obviously what she was referring to because we had been updating us on, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings. And I was like, actually, yes. And she was like, I knew you were going to say that. So,
how do you prepare for being arrested? Do you pack like a jail bag or
something?
Yeah,
we really didn't prepare. It was like 90 degrees in D.C.
Uh-huh. Do we know how long she was imprisoned after her arrest? Not long enough, says Greg Tomlin. Listen, I wish her well. She is clearly somebody who is committed to the political process. But the fact that Bernie Sanders is drawing that kind of support, look, this is important because Bernie Sanders has been able to raise an unbelievable amount of money from small donors. People like Emily Ratajkowski are capable of giving more than small donations. And if, as a lot of people expect, there is a spreading sort of a current of support in Hollywood for Bernie Sanders, which I think is extremely likely, that's going to give him a lot of bucks for Super Tuesday. Now, why is that so particularly important? California is the big prize on Super Tuesday. I mean, California is our largest state. It's overrepresented at the Democratic convention because it's such a heavily Democratic state. And if Bernie has the money to compete in all five media markets in California, the California is the only state with five separate major media markets. So it's very, very expensive to buy ads. And if Bernie has the ability to counteract Mike Bloomberg, who is going to be spending, I mean, he's apparently close to $200 million that he's thrown into this thing already. The entire thing is, again, it makes you question that principle that people who have actually earned the money know better how to spend it when you look at Mike Steyer and Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg. In any event, there is another story from the political trenches, and this from pretty deep behind enemy lines. Marianne Williamson, who I know was your favorite candidate, certainly one of our favorite candidates, has announced she is withdrawing from the race.
I felt very little respect here.
Okay, this is her statement, and she says at the very beginning, I ran for president to help forge another direction for our country. Which is a strange use of language. How do you forge a direction? Okay.
And so it is.
She says, I wanted to discuss things I felt needed to be discussed that otherwise were not. I feel that we have done that. The primaries might be tightly contested among the top contenders, and I don't want to get in the way of a progressive candidate winning any of them. As of today, therefore, I'm suspending my campaign. Now, here's the way she describes her campaign. From rescuing underserved, at-risk, and traumatized children to protectively waging an agenda for peace and making humanity itself America's greatest ally, to integrative health models within our healthcare system and incentivizing health, to reparations to achieve deeper reconciliation between races. She's talking about $500 billion. In reparations to African Americans, to the creation of a more mindful politics, to changing from an economic to a humanitarian bottom line, to initiating a season of moral repair. We brought issues to the fore that I hope contributed to the campaign season. Absolutely did. Yes, her contributions to this campaign have been enormous, prodigious. I remain as committed to them going forward as I was on the day we began.
Where there is only love.
And she concludes on that note, too. Finally, these are not times to despair. They are simply times to rise up. Things are changing swiftly and dramatically in this country, and I have faith that something is awakening among us. A politics of conscience is still yet possible, and yes, love will prevail. Will love prevail? And why is it that some folks who generally support the left are attacking some of the recent strategies and statements by people on the extreme left? And by the way, there's an attack in Chicago involving something more than human. We'll get to that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
And we see in the middle of our mind a golden light.
The Michael Medved Show.
On the Michael Medved Show, I think it's striking that there are press operations where even if you have a piece that basically makes Democrats look terrible, you're going to find a way to blame Donald Trump. And David Brooks, who's a friend of mine, but David is not pro-Trump. I think it's very, very doubtful that he would even vote for the president, even if the president's voting against running against Bernie Sanders. By the way, for the record, I will 100% vote for the president above the threat of Bernie Sanders as president of the United States. I think that is a real threat to the republic. And that's even before he appoints Emily Ratajkowski as Secretary of State.
It is basically insane.
Okay. David Brooks actually has a great piece in the New York Times today where I think most Republicans and most Trump supporters would say, hey, way to go. He attacks the anti-Trump echo chamber. And he says, in the anti-Trump echo chamber, that's not how most people were thinking. He's talking about how General McChrystal, remember him? And Michael Mullen, a retired admiral, praised Trump's decision to go after Soleimani. And Brooks writes, in the anti-Trump echo chamber, that's not how most people are thinking. Led by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they avoid the hard, complex problem of how to set boundaries around militias. Instead, they pontificated on the easy question, not actually on the table. Should we have a massive invasion of Iran? A great cry went up from the echo chamber, he writes. We're on the brink of war. Trump is leading us to more endless wars in the Middle East. We're on the precipice of total chaos. This was not the calibrated language of risk and reward. It was fear-stoking, apocalyptic language. By being so overwrought and so exaggerated, the anti-Trump echo chamber drowned out any practical conversation about how to stabilize the Middle East so we could have another righteous chorus of Donald Trump is a monster. And then he writes, most of this week's argument about the Middle East wasn't really about the Middle East. The world is more complicated than this cartoon, writes David Brooks. Love him or hate him, Trump has used military force less than any other president since Jimmy Carter. When it comes to foreign policy, he's not like recent Republicans. He is, as my colleague Ross Douthat put it, a Jacksonian figure, wanting to get America out of foreign entanglements while lobbing a few long-distance attacks to ensure the crazy foreigners stick to killing one another, not killing us. We fight viciously about Trump. He goes on. And okay, so the punchline here is, so what headline do they give to this interesting column, which I think makes a number of very, very strong points? And this is not David's headline. It's the New York Times headline. Headline is, Trump has made us all stupid. Okay, I get it, and you could say that there is an element, but that's not what his column is about. And for Democrats to blame Trump for their excesses and stupidity, it's just ridiculous. Take, for instance, Mazie Hirono. Please take her. And take my wife. Yeah, please take her. Take her. Take Mazie Hirono. Could be the dumbest of all U.S. senators. And she's a senator from Hawaii, senior senator from Hawaii.
Just shut up and step up.
And Crazy Mazie has this to say about the coming impeachment trial in the United States Senate. Listen.
So let's get back to what we really should be doing, which is what kind of a trial are we going to have in the Senate? Is it going to be a fair trial or is it going to be a rigged trial? Allison, just as the president tried to rig his reelection by trying to get the Ukrainian president to go along with his political scheme, he's trying to, with the help of Mitch McConnell, rig the Senate trial by not calling appropriate witnesses and producing documents. The president has been stonewalling this impeachment process the whole way. And now he has an opportunity in the trial to present his case. And presenting his case means presenting facts and evidence, not saying this is a witch hunt. That is not evidence. That's just rhetorical, what I call rhetorical nothing burgers.
The president is trying to rig the trial. He doesn't have to rig the trial. There are 53 Republican votes. You know how many he actually needs? He needs 34, right? If he has 34 of the 53 Republicans voting with him, he's fine. They can go ahead and have their trial. the whole idea of President Trump trying to rig elections. Now, look, I know Trump talked like this in the last campaign, and he still talks like this. He said that in one of the debates, I think it was the third debate with Hillary, he said, there's a chance the election will be rigged. It was a terrible thing to say. He was wildly criticized for it. But now the Democrats are saying the same kind of stuff. You can say that there was a desire for improper foreign involvement with his urging President Zelensky to go ahead and investigate or announce an investigation with Joe Biden about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. Okay, improper foreign involvement. But does that amount to rigging the election? When you use terms like rigging the election, you're talking about like old-fashioned stuff like miscounting the votes or losing ballots or fixing recounts. And there is zero evidence that President Trump has tried any of that. Or frankly, and there's very little evidence that that was tried against him by Hillary Clinton. And by the way, that is also worth mentioning. Today is a day when John Huber is a U.S. attorney who was initially appointed deputy U.S. attorney by President Bush. He's from Utah. I don't believe he has a partisan identification, but he was selected by Jeff Sessions when Jeff Sessions was attorney general to investigate Hillary Clinton and her involvement in the Clinton Foundation and the emails and all of the charges against Hillary Clinton. And there are tons and tons of them. And apparently John Huber, who he came in under the Bush administration as assistant U.S. attorney in Utah. He was then promoted in the Obama administration. But still, he's the one selected by Jefferson Sessions, right? Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, Trump's attorney general. And that happened because when Mueller was appointed to investigate Trump, President Trump said, yeah, how about somebody to investigate Clinton? So that's who they appointed to investigate Clinton. He now says there's no basis for charging her with anything. Okay, so does that mean Hillary Clinton is blameless and she's as pure as the driven snow? Of course not. I think she's a corrupt politician. I think there was wrongdoing at the Clinton Foundation and elsewhere. However, it's not indictable. And again, I think it's healthy and cleansing for our politics if we can drop the stuff that people with whom you disagree, especially washed up politicians with whom you disagree. And I hate to say it, Hillary Clinton is a washed up politician. She's done. She's not going to run for anything.
You creep.
Her daughter, Chelsea, might run. I mean, that's possible. Or who knows, her son-in-law, Mark. But I think it's too early for the grandchildren. No, Hillary Clinton's not running for anything. And again, we talked yesterday about her saying good morning on that very strange tweet. Did she know in advance that she was being cleared by John Huber? Maybe. Maybe that's what that was about. I still can't figure it out. There is a great deal to figure out. One of the things to figure out is with two very big movies, star-studded movies, coming out this weekend, what should you see? There's a big new raunchy comedy. It's supposed to be about women in the corporate world and the high-stakes world of female beauty. It stars Tiffany Haddish and Selma Hayek and Rose Byrne. Is it worth seeing? We'll tell you coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.